This is a special 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe, and our first conversation with a singer-songwriter from the 70s actually took place in 2008, around the time that Jackson Browne released Time the Conqueror, which was his first top 20 record since releasing Lawyers in Love in 1983. Jackson's first record, Saturate Before Using, is a singer-songwriter classic that even had a hit song on it with Dr. My Eyes. His live album, Running on Empty, in 1977, proved to be his bestseller. He has a long history of social activism and was one of the founders of the No Nukes movement in California in the 70s. I asked him how he got comfortable writing political songs that are both urgent and listenable.
Well, I've always been interested and politically engaged in that I would show up at rallies or demonstrations and I would go hear people speak. And I didn't have songs that were necessarily on the subjects of a lot of these issues, but I began reading on this one tour, began reading books about Vietnam. And I read like three back to back. I think I read A Rumor of War and Dispatches, and I think I read this book, Salvador, right after them, and it was a Joan Didion book about Central American politics. And I began to realize that the same issues were sort of present in both eras, really about 20 years apart. And I don't know, the first morning I woke up and looked at what I had written the night before, late at night, and realized I was writing what I was really concerned with, I thought, I don't know if this is going to work out too well, you know. I mean, and the test to that is whether or not you can really go on singing, whether you can sing it, and whether it really. So though I had my reservations, I decided to go ahead and just try to complete these songs. And I do think that in the beginning, a certain amount of people in my audience were concerned or thought that I was turning a corner and would never be seen again, that I was going to like leave the subjects that I had explored before. But I think they've come to understand. I think that it took a little while, but they began to realize that, like, it's part of life. We live in very, very political times, very, very turbulent times, and these issues really affect our lives, whether we're paying attention or not. So, I think they realize that there's a place for them in every life.
Relatively recently, Running on Empty was used without your permission by some Ohio Republicans in a spot. And I would think that artists' recourse in these situations would be pretty clear.
It is. It's pretty cut and dried. I mean, the law is really clear. That's copyright infringement, and they have to pay you for your song. They can't. What's more is they have to get your permission. And so, yeah, it's copyright infringement. And though we demanded that they stop using the song, and they did, they also and demanded they pay us, you know, or they began to speak with us about paying. They just sort of alluded in some publication or other to thinking that I should have been happy with the airplay. Pretty insulting. The truth is that they have appropriated other people's songs, and they do it on a regular basis. And if they just get to use it for a week or two and then comply with the cease and desist order, aren't they just kind of poaching? Aren't they just sort of taking the song over, people's songs over and over again and using them? Somebody else made on one of these blogs made the point of like, well, where are all the right wing songwriters, you know? Like, but surely, I mean, some of these people do write songs, you know, Orrin Hatch come to think of it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They're not so many.
Yeah, that's
there
true.
Must be one or two.
There must be one or two.
You know, but it's pretty cut and dry. I think that they're gonna have to pay me. It's not really.
Well, speaking of politics, your role in politics has not gone unobserved, and your good friend Randy Newman recently wrote a little piece about this.
Jesus Christ, this thinks you're low and high. Some get rich and others just get by. Bottoms off in Africa, he's never around. Country turns his lonely eyes to who? Jackson Browne, Jackson Browne, Jackson Browne.
That's on Randy Newman's new album.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I assume you've heard that.
Yeah, I've heard it. It's really good.
Very
it's
nice.
Really funny. It's a really funny thing to say, you know.
But
because Well, because it's not true, but it also, it's really, he's been my hero for so long. I mean, there's nobody better at sort of, first place, there's nobody more American than Randy Newman. He's like Mark Twain or Will Rogers. He offers this wonderful satire about our lives, and I realized at a certain point I probably know more of his lyrics than anybody else's, except for maybe Warren Zevon's. You know, so it's great to get a shout out from him, and to also, I don't mind being skewered somewhat. You know, I mean, maybe he's talking about his people. What he's talking about is people's reluctance to sort of be that earnest. You know, no one really. It's not that nobody cares. It's just.
Jackson Browne is our guest, and he's got a new album called Time to Conquer. I wanted to play another one from here. Actually, it's hard to pick exactly what to play, but I wanted to play one called Just Say Yeah, because it's an interesting song, because if you know Jackson's, you know, catalog, you know a song called Ready or Not, which was kind of about meeting your first wife, and this seems to be kind of an equivalent song later in your life.
Yeah, I never thought of that. I suppose. It's also sort of like My Stunning Mystery Companion, and that it's a, and it's really about the same person.
Ah, but, okay.
It's also about trying to find the playfulness in the topic of forever, of how to stay in love and how to be, you know, how to. I came home and told my girlfriend, I'm writing this great song about you, you know. And eventually I would say, oh, I got a couple of verses of the song. You want to hear it? And she said, no, didn't want to hear it right now. But you want to, you know, and she basically, I think there's a reluctance on the part of anybody, really, to have somebody completely define the relationship. You want to leave things open. You want to leave, and this is I think it's a good healthy kind of self-preservation instinct, you know, to not have the thing. I mean, that's maybe why we haven't gotten married, you know, so the attempt to keep things sort of diffused, you know, and not too exactly defined.
There you go. This is Just Say Yeah.
I wanted to be somebody you'd see when you're feeling good.
Just Say Yeah, that's another one from Jackson Browne's Time to Conquer, his new album out on his own record label, where he's also been releasing these wonderful concert recording retrospectives of the times you've had a chance to, you know, kind of explain your songs and play them in front of audiences of people who've just known them for years. What was your decision in doing those albums? Because they really turned out well, and it was a really nice re-examination.
Well, I started doing a solo acoustic concerts, and at the time I started, wasn't sure if I had enough, you know, to do a whole concert, that I could, you know, do enough stuff by myself. Because I've always played, you know, like a few songs acoustically, even out with a band. But those concerts turned to be longer. I never would really stick to the set list. People would start yelling for stuff, and it was such an intimate feeling. And it also, like, it impressed my girlfriend. Like, she said, what was that? You know, she said after the show, she said, that was fantastic. What was that song? And that one, and I've never heard these songs. I said, well, you know, you haven't been around that long, so... Right away, people started saying, you're recording these shows, right? You're going to put these out, right? And I said that I would, but it just took me a while to get to it.
Just had a couple more questions, and I'm thinking I read this wrong. And if this is wrong, it's going to sound really stupid. But is it true that you live off the power grid and you have your own wind farm?
Well, it's not a wind farm. I don't sell the energy. I mean, I have had... a house. It's in the Santa Barbara area, and it's really, unfortunately I don't live there full time, but it is my main residence. I mean, it's the only house that I have that is really, I mean, I built it, and I hope to get to live there full time eventually. But when I first built it, it was only half as big. I mean, I've been, you know, kind of working on it steadily, but I mean, it was always off the grid. That's the thing about this area. A lot of houses up there are off the grid. And recently, like maybe in the 5 or 6 years ago, the energy came up the canyon, and I would have been able to, you know, like plug into the grid. But at that time, I'd already been off the grid 20 years. I didn't need it, and didn't want to spoil a good thing. Now, what I really like to do is like take my family house I grew up in, and that's right in the heart of LA now, and make that all go off the grid. You know, like basically, that's my next project. I sell enough of these, but yeah, it's not that hard to do. You can be totally off the grid. It's not especially now. And you know, the solar and photovoltaic technology has just rocketed in the last few years. Now is the time for the government to subsidize those and give people tax breaks and incentives to do this for themselves, because it's a chance for the United States to really lead the way. You know, recently, right now you have the nuclear industry really trying to make a case for nuclear as the solution to global warming, and it's not. I mean, a lot of kinds of warming happens in the producing of, in the enriching of nuclear fuel, the uranium, you know, and then also in the waste. I mean, you actually have to use electricity to keep it cool. So when they say that they don't produce any, it's not true. Matter of fact, they've had to shut a couple plants, one in France and one in, one in Finland or something, that have heated the local rivers to like more than 90 degrees, and fish are dying. And like, there's all kinds of, you know, global warming that happens because of nuclear plants. So, and then they always point at France as the example of a country that's on 80% nuclear, and they're having a terrible time, actually. And it's very unpopular. Around the time of the anti-nuclear concerts, the anti-nuclear movement, and all that attention that the issue got in the late 70s, when I got this ranch, and I it was always a point of pride for me to go ahead and try to live this way, try to find out what it would take to do it. And it went from having, you know, sheds full of car batteries and a wind generator. I still got the same wind generator, which is, it's really, you know, the future's here.
Jackson Browne recorded in 2008 around the time of the release of his album Time the Conqueror. Coming up, two 70s icons who recently packed concert halls performing together. It's Carole King and James Taylor when we return to the World Cafe. This is another anniversary edition of the World Cafe, looking back at some of the greats of the singer-songwriter world in the 70s, including Carole King, whose extensive songwriting career preceded her best-selling and era-defining album Tapestry in 1971. That included writing hits for Aretha Franklin, The Cookies, The Shirelles, Little Eva, and literally hundreds more. She has 55 pages of songwriting credits on allmusic.com. To begin our conversation in 2002, after she had just put out the album Love Makes the World, I asked her if she ever wrote songs that she wasn't comfortable singing herself.
That's an interesting question, because there are songs that I write that I think I cannot sing or I should not be singing. And then I sing on the demo and I think, well, you know, it doesn't sound good with me singing it. And I find that I am singing it. Because no one else is singing it on the demo. Sometimes I'll do a co-write and my co-writer will sing. For example, I write with Gary Burr, who is a Nashville-based writer. And a lot of times I'll just say, Gary, please sing it. You have so much of a better voice. And he does, and he does. But a lot of times I don't think I can sing something and I wind up doing it because I have to.
What is the attraction of collaborating for you? You've always been a collaborator.
I like both. I like having another mind to bounce off of and to spring me into a new direction. But when I write songs by myself, without getting cosmic, it is sort of a collaboration. I feel like whatever the muse is, whatever energy is allowing me to work with it and sends the ideas through, it is kind of a collaboration.
You know, it's funny. I hear that from the bulk of the songwriters we talk to, they talk about, well, it just came through me. And I'm surprised to hear it from you, because you've always been in that kind of pressure, or not always, but you've, you know, in the past been in that kind of pressure, writing a song to fulfill an assignment, kind of a place. I'm surprised that still holds true.
Well, it's, I think any creative endeavor, maybe life itself, is part inspiration and part perspiration. I definitely put in the work. I have the skills and I know the craft. But you have to have those little bits and pieces that come from somewhere that you don't, you can't really say, well, I did this. It's more like I discovered this, or it came through me. But yeah, there's a lot of work to it, and you know, craft, and I enjoy that very much. But I also enjoy watching something come out of me that I was like, wow, that was good.
One of the things that you resurrect on this is a version of Oh No, Not My Baby, which is one of the simplest. It sounds like, when you talk about doing demos, this one really sounds like a demo. Was that the case?
It kind of was. And I, there's actually two parts to this story about Oh No, Not My Baby. The first part is how this record came to be. One day at one of the early sessions, I was working with Umberto Gatica, the engineer and co-producer on the album, and Carol Bayer Sager, and we were talking about, oh, well, maybe we'll do a demo of that and see if we can work with Lauryn Hill on an arrangement of it, you know. And so I just sort of whipped out this demo live, me playing the piano and singing just at the same time, unheard of, right? And that was that, and then we forgot about it, and we never even thought about it. And then when we did, I only had this one DAT, a simple two-track digital recording of it. I couldn't find anything. I couldn't separate the tracks. I couldn't fix the vocal. I couldn't fix the piano. I couldn't do anything. And I thought, you know what? There's something magic about it. So I added my ex-husband, Charlie Larkey, who played bass on Tapestry. He played acoustic bass on this, and there you have it.
When my friends told me you had someone new, I didn't believe a single word was true. I showed them all I had faith in you. I just kept on saying, oh no, not my baby.
You know, Carol, I was listening to that song and I was thinking back to a number of the other ones that you and Jerry wrote way back when. Those songs, if you take the message in there, you know, there's a song about, I mean, you know, my baby wouldn't cheat on me, will you still love me tomorrow, a song that, you know, there's certainly a message in there. You were providing, in some ways, kind of an alternate moral code for a lot of young women, you know, another voice besides their parents. And I'm curious as to whether you thought about that, or looking back, that has any resonance.
Not at all.
Yeah.
In fact, let me give credit where credit is due. I was providing the la-la-la-la. Jerry Goffin was providing the moral code. He was the lyricist on those songs.
Oh, okay, interesting. Oh, I'll throw that theory out. another collaboration would be with your daughter Louise Goffin on the theme to the Gilmore Girls. Was that the first time you sung with her?
Probably, yes. I think that's the first time we've sung publicly. I mean, we like playing music together.
Right.
We each do our own thing, but when we work together, it's easy. It's like butter.
So you don't get into a mother-daughter relation. It's more peer at that point.
Totally.
Did you ever steer her away from the business? I know she's been at it for a while.
Yes. When she was 12 years old, I said to her, came to me and said, I want to do what you do. I want to be a singer and a songwriter and a musician. And I said, here are the drawbacks.
Yeah.
Not only all the expected drawbacks, but by that time I had had Tapestry, so I was pretty, you know, world famous. And I said, you may have that to overcome as well. And she said, I don't care. I really want to do it. And she has never looked back. She's gone just like a laser on that path.
How did your parents feel about you pursuing this?
My parents were really supportive and helpful. My dad was a New York City fireman, And he used to use his badge to get me in to meet people like Alan Freed. So they were really supportive.
I'm curious, you know, there you are sneaking into Alan Freed shows. Who were the songwriters, or what were the songs that were exciting you? I mean, so many songwriters today say, you know, Carole King is somebody they look to. Who were you looking to? And why did you pick songwriting? Why not being, you know, the pop star?
Double question.
Yeah.
The first part of it, I grew up actually listening to classical music and show tunes like Rodgers and Hammerstein. Rodgers and Hart were kind of my earliest idols. And then, you know, with the Alan Freed shows, that was a whole new world, rock and roll. You know, after you've seen Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry, you kind of go, oh, okay. But I always wanted to be a songwriter rather than a performer because I never liked performing that much. I wanted to be the person that whose name people would know, like, so that if I wanted to go backstage and meet these people, I could, because they'd know my name as a songwriter. But I didn't want to be the one out there trying to win over audiences and do the whole thing. And interestingly enough, I got my goal. I wanted to be able to talk to anyone, to call up Eric Clapton and say, hey, will you come and play on my City Streets album? And he did. But I inadvertently became an artist, and I'm still, in my own mind, I'm still a singer. I mean, I'm still a songwriter first. And when I am a singer, I love it. I enjoy it. But that's one of the reasons I don't do a lot of it, because I don't ever want to burn out on it. If I don't love being up on that stage, I shouldn't be there. And so far, I always do.
Carole King, recorded in 2002. Next up, James Taylor. He and Carole King toured together in 2010. And more importantly, Taylor had his first number one hit in 1971 with You've Got a Friend, one of the songs that Carole recorded for her Tapestry album. James Taylor defines the 70s singer-songwriter movement with albums like the classic Sweet Baby James from 1970 with the song Fire and Rain. James Taylor joined us in 2008 when he released an album called Covers. I asked him at the time why he decided to do an album of other people's songs.
It's been something I've wanted to do for years. The band that I work with, some of us have been together since the mid-70s, and you know, we have a sort of a repertoire. All the songs that we do live aren't always my songs exclusively. We play a lot of things of other people's, and there were a number of these songs that we evolved over the years that we had great arrangements of and that really worked beautifully. So I've had in mind for a number of years to finally get that into the studio and to make a band album. Essentially, it was a quick album. It took us 10 days. We essentially recorded it live. There was only one overdub on the entire record. We got Yo-Yo Ma to overdub on Leonard Cohen's song Suzanne. But aside from that, everything was done on the spot and at the same time.
In terms of the material, have your tastes changed over the years, you think, since you were younger?
No, they haven't. I think I was formed, you know, by about the age of 20, I was probably kind of formed musically. Yes, I've heard things that have excited me since then, but the major influences, the people who taught me music, first my parents and their musical tastes impressed themselves on me at an early age. Then my brother Alex, my older brother, had very strong musical opinions and just a passion for music, mostly soul music. That and the sort of latent country music that was around us all in North Carolina, those were my early inspiration. Then I began to meet other players, and they would teach me stuff, and I learned a huge amount from people like Tom Rush, and you know, who's a folk player. Jim Queskin's Jug Band and the Charles River Valley Boys. Those two bands taught me a lot. And then when I moved to New York City at the age of 18 and started playing there, we had a drummer, a guy named Joel O'Brien. And Joel was like an encyclopedia of music.
Well, now, do you want to start on the soul end of things or country? What would you like to play first?
Well, I think I'm going to play what would probably be thought of as a folk song. This is a Leonard Cohen tune that we recorded. I used to play this song in sound checks. Dave Morgan, my front of house mixer, when I play live, would say, I typically do a line check on all the various instruments, and then he'll say to me, give me something, voice and guitar. And often as not, this is what I play. Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can see the boats go by and you can spend the night forever. You know she's half crazy and that's why you want to be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, she gets you on her wavelength and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And Jesus was a sailor when he walked out on the water, and he spent a long time watching from a lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the seas freed them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. And you want to travel with him, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, 'cause you've touched his perfect body with your mind. Suzanne takes your hand, she leads you by the water. She's wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor. She shows you where to look between the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning. They are leaning out for love, and they will lean that way forever, while Suzanne holds the mirror. And want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust her, 'cause she's touched your perfect body with her mind.
Singer and a song that need not too much introduction. James Taylor doing Suzanne. And of course, if there are two songs you think of with Suzanne in them, one of them, of course, is yours too. So.
The reason I used the name Suzanne in Fire and Rain was probably informed by, you know, this, generated by having been so into that song by Judy Collins, you know, Leonard Cohen's song as sung by Judy Collins.
Now, you mentioned some of these other versions of things. Is that a difficulty when you're doing a covers album to not think of other arrangements, not think of other ways of doing it?
You know, this is the thing. If it's a song you love, it's often an excellent recording as well. You're not going to really improve on it. That's not the criterion. You have to have some kind of new take on it, some kind of an angle on it. Often it's, you know, just a different voice and different instrumentation. Sometimes it's a whole new arrangement, different way of harmonizing the thing. I don't know if this happened to you. When I was a kid, you could buy these albums that were advertised on television, or you'd pick up this album that had the hits on it that you wanted, you know, and then you'd take the thing home and play it, and it was like some pale reanimation, you know,
right.
Just some terrible cardboard version of the thing that you really wanted, and what a disappointment that was, what a ripoff. So that you don't want to do that with a cover album. You want it to be a different thing.
Absolutely. Well, good. I'm glad you had that experience, because
yes,
you did a good job with this. Now, what's next?
One of the main things about the covers album was that it was a group effort, and it's difficult for me with a solo guitar to give you more tunes from it. I probably have to now depart from the covers album and play you something of my own, if I may.
I think that's okay.
Okay. This is a song that I wrote sitting on the stair, on a stairway in my house on Martha's Vineyard in probably 76, maybe, 1976. A song that sometimes you'll get the germ of a song and then it'll be years before you can manage to finish it. This song was delivered in a single package all at once, and I wish that would happen more often. Well, the secret of life is enjoying the passage of time. Any fool can do it. There ain't nothing to it. Nobody knows how we got to the top of the hill. But since we're on our way down, we might as well enjoy the ride. Secret love isn't opening up your heart. It's okay to feel afraid. Don't let it stand in your way no longer. Everyone knows that love is the only road. And since we're only here for a while, we might as well show some style. Give us a smile now, isn't that a lovely ride? Gliding down and gliding down, and try not to try too hard. It's just a lovely ride. Now the thing about time is that time isn't really real. It's all on your point of view. How does it feel for you in there? Yeah. Einstein said that he could never understand it all. Planets spinning through space, the smile upon your face. Welcome to the human race. Isn't that a lovely ride? See me sliding down and gliding down, and try not to try too hard. It's just a lovely ride. La 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 no no. Isn't that a lovely ride? Oh yeah. Sliding down and gliding down and try not to try too hard. It's just a lovely ride. The secret of life is enjoying the passage of time.
James Taylor recorded in 2008 around the time of his album called Covers. Coming up, Joni Mitchell talks about recording her album Hajira, working with the bass player Jaco Pastorius, her tunings, her polio, and much more when we get right back to this 20th anniversary edition of The World Cafe. This 20th anniversary edition of The World Cafe continues. Now we are really going back in the archives for this 1994 interview with the groundbreaking singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. It was around the time of her album Turbulent Indigo, which went on to win a Best Pop Album Grammy. Joni Mitchell is in a category of her own. Her works with voicings, phrasings, tunings were all revolutionary. The quality of her string of albums from Blue in 1971 through Hajira in 1976 is unprecedented and certainly unduplicated. Hajira was particularly original and started her foray into jazz, recording with bassist Jaco Pastorius, a member of the group Weather Report. I asked her about using Jaco, known for his melodic explorations on electric bass.
I was hearing the bass as I learned, as I was adding colors to my own music, I had opinions about them. And one of the things that disappointed me when bassists came into play on the music was, why did they always root the chord? So I would encourage them to lift off the bottom and go up into the mid-range and travel around and throw in some counter and come back down. And they'd say, then there would be rebellion. Also, the sound of the bass at that time was, bass players didn't change their strings. Dead strings was in vogue, and I craved a more resonant, round, ringing bass sound. And you couldn't get them to go against the hip. I tried a lot of bass players, and I guess they all heard this lament. Well, why? Finally, somebody said, you know, there's this kid that plays in Florida. He plays like with Bob Hope and Phyllis Diller in some of these show places. He's a really weird bass player. They said, you know, you might like him. So I sent for Jaco, and when he showed up with that sound, you know, And he had a terribly bushy ego. I mean, I loved it. He offended everyone in town in a very short space by saying things like, I'm the baddest bass player in the world. I'm not bragging, I'm just telling the truth. But to me, you know, he was telling the truth because he wasn't playing the root of the chord. He was zipping up and playing like little Stravinsky counter melodies. And, you know, oh, it was just thrilling. But, I mean, he did mix himself up really hot in the mix on that album. Like, you know, I had more of a blend between him and the guitar, but he kept going, no, and he'd push himself. I'm almost his background singer on Hajira. But, you know, that too was a new idea. The bottom end of music was changing. Stevie Wonder was one of the pioneers. And I took people over to Stevie's because he was using Moog bass and saying, look, you know, the rhythm is not, you know, all these little ditzy sounds and these dead sounds, you know, the kick with the pillow in it. And listen to what Stevie's doing. You know, like, I mean, Stevie's one of the great composers of this century. But all of that, it was just hard to buck the hip. You know, the hip is very a communal concept.
That coyote's at my door. He pins me in a corner and he won't take no. He drags me out on the dance floor and we're dancing close and slow. Now he's got a woman at home. He's got another woman down the hall. He seems to want me anyway. Why'd you have to get so drunk and leave me on that way? You just picked up a hitcher, a prisoner of the white lines on the freeway.
Coyote from Joni Mitchell. We were talking about bass player on most all that album, Hajira, Jaco Pastorius. Probably one of your biggest influences on other people has been your guitar sound and your tunings. I was wondering, on your first record, you were using your tunings. When did you first discover what
almost,
you could do?
Almost immediately when I began to write my own music. I had polio, and my left hand is a bit impaired. I was never going to develop the facility to get at the chords that I heard in my head. There were tunings floating around that came out of the black blues tradition, mostly major open major chords, and there was D modal, which is, you know, the drop D, and people knew of those. And of course, there was a Hawaiian slack key tradition, but that hadn't really leaked into folk music much at that point. So it was Eric Anderson who showed me open G, I think, and Tom Rush played in open C. I collected a few of them. I think Buffy St. Marie had a couple of her own. I just started tuning the guitar to the chords that I like.
Are you still developing different
tunings? Oh, yeah. I have 50.
Yeah.
50 tunings, and those are the ones that I've written songs in. So for every one of them, I've probably lost maybe 75 tunings at this point and lost them just because I didn't write anything in them.
I wanted to play Turbulent Indigo because it has some wonderful moving, the song, because it has some wonderful moving vocal harmonies. What's the story behind this song?
Well, let's see. It's a long tale. And I don't mean to be bashing the Canadian Council of the Arts, but I was invited in, I forget what year it was, but a few years ago, to speak to the Canadian Council of the Arts from my heart on art and education. And it was to be held in my hometown of Saskatoon on the 23rd of May. 23rd of May is the day before my mother's birthday. So I thought, well, it would be an opportunity to be home for Mom's birthday, which was something I hadn't really done. You know, I've been away in my adult life. I've never been there on the day of her birthday. So partially I accepted it for that reason. When I got there, I received a pamphlet which had been distributed among the members of the council. And on it were listed 8 topics of discussion, I think, for whatever it was, a 4 or 5 day conference. I was the last speaker of the conference. Two of the topics of discussion really kind of disturbed me in a way, and I thought, gee, if I'd seen this thing, I wouldn't have done it. You know, I would have known what I was walking into. One of them was, it said, and this was given, I think, an afternoon's discussion, now that the arts are being taught at the high school level in Saskatoon and, I believe, British Columbia, does that mean that we have to become artists in order to teach art? I thought, well, I would hope so, you know. I mean, I would hope you'd have a teacher that knew something about the subject. So the second offensive topic on this portfolio was, we're going to make Van Goghs. And that was the name of the conference. We're going to make Van Goghs. You know, we're going to make Van Goghs out of Native Canadians, women, and other ethnic groups. Well, anyway, I got up and I gave my 2 speeches, and I'm sure that there were bright and creative people in that audience, but they didn't come forth, and they didn't, you know, all I saw the painters were the first to leave. They left first, and the next day in the newspaper it said, we don't need some rich rock star who left the country years ago standing up there and telling us that she's a serious artist. So I suddenly realized I was in the damnable position of being asked to speak on art and education from my heart when for most of the house I had no credibility. So the song, I said, as I threw it open to questioning and received questions like, what other famous people do you know? You know, did you ever consider being a teacher? You know, I said, look, you know, I don't think you can make artists. Artists are born. I mean, the real artists are born. You know, they're both the disease and the vaccination. So, anyway, I was not a popular speaker.
But you got this song, Turbulent Indigos.
You wanna make Van Goghs, raise them up like sheep. Make them out of Eskimos and women, if you please. Make them nice and normal, make them nice and neat. See him with his shotgun there, blooded in the wheat. Oh, what do you know about living in turbulent indigo?
Joni Mitchell is our guest on the World Cafe. I know you haven't performed in a while. Would you consider doing that, or is it mostly a physical problem holding?
Yeah,
holding instruments.
I am a polio survivor, and we now have a kind of another gauntlet to run, it turns out. You know, it's kind of like post-polio syndrome is a little bit like multiple sclerosis. You know, your wiring is kind of burning out.
Mm.
So, and the muscles in my back, are a lot of them are gone, you know, and the ones that are left are being driven by wires that are, one wire that should be driving one muscle is maybe driving three or four, and they're weakening. And so the contortion that you put yourself in a guitar lead, you know, can lead to pain. And yeah, I don't want to get
yeah,
it.
Right, right.
I don't like to think about it because too much. But that's part of the reason. The other reason is like not a pretty topic either. But like I'm not an arena artist, and my music doesn't suit big halls. The cost of renting little halls is amazing. And we are the artist pays all the expenses, everybody's hotel rooms. Last time I was out 9 months, and, you know, I made less than the roadie. You know, people don't realize, the artist is the last to get paid. So to go out for a period of time and break even is not attractive in my condition.
Joni Mitchell from our conversation in 1994, right when Turbulent Indigo came out. On this 20th anniversary edition of the World Cafe, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Additional support provided by the members of our World Cafe affiliates nationwide, including KNBA in Anchorage, Alaska. Shows produced at WXPN from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm David Dye. This is the World Cafe.